Hello and welcome to Yamaha Music's podcast, Artist Insights. My name is Phoebe Ely, and I'm going to be taking you behind the scenes to give you an exclusive insight into the lives and journeys of some of Yamaha's leading artists. My guest today is known as one of the best jazz trombonists in Europe. His creativity, distinctive sound, and ability to connect deeply to his audiences are just a few reasons as to why the incredible Nils Landgren has had such an enriching and successful career. He has toured with the likes of Björn and contributed to at least 500 albums by international groups and musicians such as ABBA, The Crusaders, Eddie Harris, Herbie Hancock, and many, many more. Nils is not only a legendary trombonist, he also holds the title of Artistic Director for the Jazz Baltica Festival, and as well as this, has been decorated with two medals from the King Carl Gustaf in Sweden. Nils, how are you doing? Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much, Phoebe. I'm very happy to be here. Sweden shows itself from its best side today, and I'm very happy about that. I spend the day at home, and yeah.
Oh, I can imagine. Beautiful nature surrounding you. And, well, what an introduction that was. You've achieved so much in so many different areas and genres of music, and what a career and journey that you've had. And I'd like to take you right back to the start of where it all began, if I may, where you first discovered the trombone at the age of 13. And I wonder, what was your first memory of the instrument itself and of playing live music?
Well, the instrument itself was weird, you know, because I picked it up one day after school because there was a trombone in the hallway in our house. Because my father usually, he always tried to repair music instruments. He was a trumpet player himself. And, you know, for the little music band that we had in our community, he always did that. And there was a trombone there, and I tried it. And I thought, oh, this is strange, but somehow I liked it. And I asked him when he got back from work, could you show me something? And he showed me a couple of things, and I was hooked. So that was my very first experience with the instrument. And ever since, I'm trying to master the instrument as good as I can.
Oh, the rest is history. I think you've done a very good job so far.
Thank you.
And I wonder, what did your childhood look like, Nils, in terms of music? Who or what gave you that inspiration to pursue playing and make it a career?
I think my father, in the first place, because as he was a hobby musician, he was a welder actually in the steel factory, but his hobby was to play music. My mother loved to sing, and my brothers were very musical as well. So I think they all inspired me. But the fact that I got to be around music a lot through my father, that kind of brought me into the music in the first place. And I started to play drums when I was 6 years old, but then I got tired of it at 13. So, and then this happened with the trombone in the hallway. So my inspiration was really, you know, everything that happened around me with all the musicians that my father used to play with. I mean, they were all amateurs, which means they loved what they were doing.
Yeah.
And that was great.
That's an amazing experience to have just right at the start as well. And do you remember your very first experience of live music and going to your first concert? What did that look like for you?
Oh, I mean, the first concert I ever went to, I guess, it was with a marching band in our hometown. Because there was, you know, there was all the music there was. So that was the first thing I ever heard live. Except, I guess, my father played, you know, they rehearsed with his band at home. But, I mean, I was so young then. So the marching band was the first experience with live music. And then, luckily, I had the chance to hear, like, there was a blues band coming to our little city that kind of threw me totally, you know, in another direction. And then I saw the Beatles on TV.
On their first
appearance on Swedish television in 1964, I think it was. And that totally blew my mind. I thought it was so great. It was just something totally different. And I've been a great Beatles fan ever since.
Oh, I love it. I love it. They are obviously fantastic and legendary. So that's a very good choice.
Yeah.
And you started off at music college in Karlstad studying classical trombone. And I'm wondering, at what point do you remember wanting to go down a different path and explore the world of improvisation?
Well, I think it started quite early because when I was, I think, 14 and I had played for a year, my teacher, he started a big band at the music school and I got to play my first solo It really sucked, but I got to try it, and so that, you know, that got me kind of into it a little bit. But I think I didn't really want to go a different path completely until I was maybe 20 or something. I mean, I tried over the years between 14 and 20, but I became professional when I was 20. So that was, yeah, and then I already was into another kind of music.
Yeah, because you moved to Stockholm, didn't you, to then go on to be a professional trombone player. And before you know it, you're touring with the most successful Swedish pop star of all that time, which was Björn. What did that time look like for you? And how did you cope with the transition from going from being a student to working with some of the most successful bands in the world?
I think it was quite seamless, actually, because I decided when I was 16 and a half that I was going to become a professional trombone player, because I thought that I could bring something that maybe other people didn't have. So I worked very hard to work my chops and work my skills as good as I could. And when I got the opportunity, which was like by coincidence, I think, to play with Björn Skifs, who just, he had his US number one hooked on a feeling by then. And well, they found me, you know, at the, where you look for people that don't have a job, unemployment, something.
Oh, they scouted you out and they found you?
Yeah, they did. And I had some recommendations from a sax player who played with ABBA, and he said I was good. So they tried me out and I got the gig with Björn, and that led me into to record with, well, in the first place with ABBA, which I did in 79. You know, one thing led to another. But when I moved to Stockholm, I was quite convinced that I would make it. And then after 1 year or 8 months, I was convinced I wouldn't make it. But then Björn called me and that changed the whole thing. So,
yeah. What shifted in terms of when you had that real drive and you knew that you were going to make it and you had that really positive attitude? What happened that shifted that into perhaps, oh, I'm not sure if this is for me, before you got the call from Björn? How did that look for you?
Well, I got a confirmation, you see. I mean, for me, it was like somebody saw me. Somebody thought that I was good. And it turned out that they continued to think that I was good.
How did you cope through that low point? How did you get through mentally as a musician, knowing that you've got this talent and that you just need that one break? How did you cope during those months?
Well, I didn't have much of a choice. I mean, I could have gone back to school because I hadn't finished my university studies. But, you know, in January 1976, I had made, let's say, £2.
Wow.
In a month from playing on the door once. And I thought, I mean, this is not going to pay my rent. This is not going to do anything for me. I just had the feeling that either I go back to school or I have to work harder. And then I got this call. So that really changed my life. And Björn and I, we're still very good friends, and we recently played a couple of concerts together. So it's a very good feeling.
Yeah, it's the stars just aligned. It sounds beautiful. The way it all happened is so natural and organic. And I think that's often the way, isn't it? When you're waiting for that break and it just comes. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And you went on then to record and release your first solo album in 1984. How did it feel to move towards soloistic work at this time? And what did it give to your playing?
Well, it felt great. But I, by that point, I had like ideas of doing more than playing trombone. I wanted to sing, and I was actually the first guy who did a couple of rap songs on a record in Sweden. And I realized after that I should not do any more. but I did it, and it was a great experience. And actually, I got the request from the record company that I wasn't with the record company, but I had recorded some stuff with another band. And they asked me, do you have any compositions? Do you have any, have you written anything? And I said, yeah, of course, I have music for a whole album. And I said, great, let's do it. I didn't have anything. I'd never written anything in my life.
Love that.
But I actually started to write, and I was very influenced by, you know, the new music that came from America at that time. was a lot of, there was a lot of, you know, the first hip hop records. Herbie Hancock did his like very, very hard rhythmical stuff that he did at that time. And I thought, hey, let's go for something in that direction. So my first album was called Street Fighter. And I think I was inspired by the whole scene. And I wanted to do something that sounded like a big city and, you know.
Yeah. And you have had so many different variations in your career. And you mentioned your singing just at the start of that answer. And I did want to touch on this with you. I'm really interested. How did you get into that side of performing in terms of, you have a beautiful voice. I've seen lots of your performances of your singing online and it's a gorgeous voice. How did you get into that? And also, I believe you did a bit of acting as well for TV and film.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I got into singing, I think. I mean, you start singing when you're being born, right? Yeah. At least you scream. And then when I was at university, my brother got sick and they had a party band, and he asked me, can you jump in for me? And I thought, well, why not? I mean, we sound exactly the same, me and my brother. We sound like we have asthma, and we do want to. So I sang and I thought, wow, this is fun. And so I started to, you know, I think that's the way it started. And I've had I've had high points and I have very low points when it comes to singing, because I've been very much criticized for it, the way I sing. And at one point I stopped singing, but then I felt like, well, screw it, I'll sing the way I want, and whoever likes it, like it, and the rest, they don't have to listen, so.
Exactly. I like that attitude very much. And do you find that when you're preparing for an acting role or you're preparing for a song on stage, do you have a different process to what you would normally have for your playing in terms of preparation mentally?
Well, in the first place, I don't do any acting anymore. I got a couple of roles in like, you know, those like thriller or detective series in Sweden as a bad guy. Of course.
You? I don't believe that.
Well, that's what I got to play anyway. I was casted by the directors, and I thought it was great fun. But I just realized, I mean, it's better that people who actually has an education and wants to do this stuff for their living, they should do it, and I should, you know, stick with music. Well, but when you ask about preparation for singing, for example, the main thing is to understand what I'm singing about. And that comes actually, that goes to play an instrument as well. But I mean, if you have a lyric in front of you, it's good to see if this lyric is something that you really want to sing, if it means something to you or not. And if it does, I gladly try to learn a song. And when I try to learn it, I try to really understand what it's about and then make my own interpretation of it. And the good thing is that I can play trombone as well, so I can switch between the two.
You do? Yeah, I saw in your lovely concert. It was amazing having diversity. It was beautiful. And you're so right. I think if you can connect with the lyrics of a song, the best thing about a singer is their ability to tell a story, regardless of their voice. So yeah, I think incredible that you're able to do that with both your voice and the trombone. And you have had such a hugely successful and varied career, Nils. And I'm wondering, what has been the biggest personal obstacle that you've faced to get to the point that you're at today?
I mean, one of the obstacles that you have to overcome is the fact that some people might not like what you're doing, and you get, you know, quite negative criticism for what you do. And there are two ways to go. Either you don't listen to them at all, or you pretend that you don't listen, but you do anyway. Or you actually just you go with the flow and you try to do it as good as you can, but, you know, take it with you, what people tell you, and try to make it better. But still, I have to keep I have to keep it real with myself. When I feel good about something, then it works. But that's one obstacle. But the other one is I have to practice all the time. All the time. You know, it's not like I can take off for a week or something. It doesn't work that way. I have to practice every day. And now, as I told you in the beginning, I took a little ill a couple of days ago. So I didn't practice for 2 days. And now I have to pay the price. because now I have to practice double as much. And that's really hard. But you know, it's fun too. And I'm always looking forward to play. I mean, that's the reward. That's the big reward for doing all the homework that I do.
Absolutely. And I am wondering, you've done so many incredible competitions and gigs, and what does it feel like when you're stood off stage waiting to go on? What is your go-to ritual, and what's going on inside your head at that moment just before you go on stage?
It's quite empty, actually, mostly. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do when I get on stage? Which song do we start with? How does it start? And what key was it? And what's the next song? And, well, you know, there's so many questions that goes around in your head. And sometimes it's really empty until the point where you get up to the mic and start playing or singing. And usually then everything falls into place. But it's really a weird moment just before you go on stage and start, because sometimes you have no idea what you're going to do. Even if you, I mean, everything is carefully planned and everything, but yeah. And I think it's like a process that the brain needs, at least for me, not to know what you're doing until you start doing it. And then everything like just, yeah, here we go.
It just kicks in.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, I love that. It's like the calm before the storm.
Yes.
But the storm is a beautiful storm.
Yeah.
It's great. And I'm wondering, who has been your biggest inspiration to your playing and career throughout your entire life?
Oh, there's so many, because as I told you, I heard the Beatles when I was 7 on TV. And then a couple of years later, Jimi Hendrix came to the next little town next to us. It wasn't even a town. And he played outdoors in the folk park. And I wasn't allowed to go even because I was too young. But my brother bought his first record, Are You Experienced? And when I came home from school one day, I listened to that record and I thought, it totally blew my mind. So that was a very big experience. And then a couple of years later, except from all the jazz records that my father played, because he always said, hey guys, listen to this, this is great. And he played Duke Ellington, he played Louis Armstrong, he played Count Basie and a couple of other. And it was great. It still is. But then somebody lent me a record with Miles Davis called Live at Fillmore from 1970, I think, or 71 maybe. And I listened to it. There was, you know, it was a big cover. There was a guy stretching out on the floor on a kind of a bear fur or something in you know, high boots and looking very, very chic with a trumpet. And I didn't understand the music at all. I thought, what is this? But I had to listen to it again and again and again. And it really caught me. So I think Miles Davis is like the ultimate inspiration when it comes to music. Maybe not the instrument, as I play trombone, but I was so inspired by the way he played. I mean, not always about the way he was as a person, maybe, but I don't know him or didn't know him. But the way he actually played his instrument was quite amazing.
Oh, genius. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you on that. And what an incredible, you know, legend to have learnt from through all your listening when you were younger and in that capacity. It's amazing. And I don't feel truly, Nils, that I can go through this whole interview without addressing the Red Horn, I have to be honest.
Okay.
It's an artist in itself. And I know you've been playing Yamaha trombone since 1985. And I just wonder if you can talk me through how and when you decided on this famous, beautiful, bright red colour.
Well, it has to do with Miles Davis, because he was playing, he was having, you know, he had a green trumpet. He had a black trumpet with like orange parts of it. And later on, he also had a red trumpet. And I thought, as Yamaha approached me in 1985 and asked me if I wanted to switch to their instruments, I said, yeah, I'd love to, but it has to be better than the one I play now, and it has to be red. because, I mean, that's the color of love, right? I didn't want to go with a normal instrument. And, I mean, my colleagues and friends, they thought I was crazy, but... But still, and Yamaha actually accepted it and said, okay, we'll make it. And half a year later, it arrived, you know, with the postman And I packed it up, and I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic, and I've played it ever since.
It's so distinctive. It's brilliant. It's what makes you you. And the thing that really strikes me about you, Nils, is your ability to just embrace whatever project is thrown at you. If it's something like that, you put full dedication and passion into whatever you do. And whether that's taking on the responsibility of artistic director for jazz festivals in Europe or the collaborative project between your band and MSF Funk for Life, it's another amazing example of this. So can you talk me through how that project came about? What is it for, and what led you to put this collaboration into action?
Doctors Without Borders, they started in Sweden. I approached them and offered them to make a couple of concerts and, you know, like a benefit concerts for them. And they accepted. They had no idea who I was, but we played a couple of concerts at the biggest jazz club in Stockholm, and we raised quite a lot of money. And quite many years later, they got a new boss in Sweden, MSF, Doctors Without Borders. His name is Dan Sermond. He is a French guy. And we started talking about, you know, what can we do? And as they were celebrating their 15th anniversary in Sweden, he actually asked me and my band, would you like to perform here? And we can make a big party. And then I said, yeah, of course, but let's make a big party, but let's, you know, give the money to MSF and for certain projects. And at that time, they were in South Sudan, and then they got thrown out. And we had by then made plans to kind of maybe go somewhere and see if we could make some change, maybe to bring music instruments, to give kids a chance to do something else than just either nothing or just being like, you know, bullied around by their yeah, everything around them and being poor and whatever. And after a while, they suggested that we could go to Kenya, to Nairobi, to a part of the city called Kibera, which was then quite safe. And they said, we have good infrastructure. We can actually provide you with, you know, whatever you need. So we said, great. And we started to collect instruments. We begged and borrowed and bought, and we brought as much as we could. And I talked a friend into joining with his camera crew so we could film everything that we did there. And I think it actually brought something. It brought us quite a lot of joy just to see how the kids reacted when we brought, I mean, we really brought a lot of instruments, as much as we could bring, as we could carry. We couldn't send them because then they would have, you know, they would have been taken to customs and they would have kept them and sold them. But what we could do, we could provide the instruments to schools, and the schools could lend them out to the kids. And it gave the kids a chance to do something different than their ordinary all day. If they were lucky, they could go to school. And if they were lucky to be at school, they could also use the instruments for free. So we had a great time, and we got to see how people live in such a society. I mean, that's the poorest you can find, almost. It was for somebody coming from a rich country, it's quite shocking to. But it did us very good to actually understand how people live and the pride that they show, even if they live under such circumstances. That was a great experience, and the children were fantastic. And we have continued to do this, to try to send instruments. But nowadays, it's more of trying to help people to go to school, trying to provide them with food and, you know, books and material for the school, and maybe to help people to get better grades and to, you know, to get further in life. So Funk for Life is something that continues, and it's a very, very rewarding thing to do. And I put all the efforts that I have and all the money that I have left into that. And I'm hoping that it, you know, that it does any good.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing legacy to be able to continue to move forwards with. And I'm sure absolutely it already has done a huge amount of good and incredible life-changing things for all of those people over there. So I think it's so wonderful you're still continuing with it and still, yeah, able to give that to those that need it. It's incredible.
Thank you. And at one point, the second time we went there, actually Yamaha in Germany, they started a kind of a swap thing. So they let people come in. They said, if you swap to a new Yamaha instrument, we lower the price a lot. We swap it and you get the instruments much, much, much cheaper. And a lot of people did that. And that meant that we could bring a whole bunch of instrument extra through Yamaha in Germany. So they did a great job helping us out with it. And I think that's what it's about. Yamaha has always done a great job and it's quite amazing. I'm very grateful for that.
Oh, well, we're very grateful for you for all your incredible work that you've done for us. So it's amazing. And I'm wondering now, you have performed at so many incredible places throughout your career. And I wonder, are there any soul-stirring moments during your career that you would go back and relive all over again if you could? And if so, what moment would you go back to and why?
There has been quite many moments of that. But I think one of them was when I got to perform a couple of concerts with Pat Metheny and Michael Brecker. And I think that was some of my highlights, because to be on stage with such fantastic musicians was quite amazing. And, you know, I think through that you lift yourself, because you have to lift yourself up to another level. And I think actually I did, if I look at those videos. I don't like to look at myself, but rather seldom I do. And sometimes I see something that I actually think, well, I wasn't that bad. And also I sang at the Polar Prize ceremony in Stockholm for Sting. And there's also a very nice moment to get a big hug from Sting after the performance.
Yeah.
Because he's somebody that I really look up to and I really think is very, very good.
That's amazing. I can't imagine being able to hug Sting. What an incredible moment. Just thinking about that in my head. Incredible. And do you have any, on a lighter side, any funny stories that have happened to you on stage that you thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe that just happened. Have you had any of those oh my goodness moments on stage?
Well, I've dropped my slide, for example.
Have you?
That's quite bad. and it has happened a couple of times, because it happens just because, well, something happens and you think of something else and it just, you know, slides away. Yeah. And luckily when that happened, nothing happened to the slide, because if it falls on a flat surface, nothing happens. But on other occasions, I have actually banged it into my microphone stand, and that means that when you try to play again, you can't move the slide. That's a very awkward situation, and it doesn't feel good, because the show is over in a way, because you can't play. I mean, you can play, the overtone series where the slide got stuck, but that's it. So, I mean, that's not a fun moment, but
no,
but it happens.
Character building.
Yeah, you can say so. And you have to use a lot of violence to move the slide, if at all possible.
Oh, gosh. Wow. All the things that you have to consider being an international musician is amazing. And I do have a final question for you now, Nils, which has become an Artist Insights favourite, which is, if you could give one piece of advice to an 18-year-old Nils, what would it be and why?
I would say practice as much as you can on the things that you think that you're going to need, but don't forget to have fun while doing it.
Love that. Love that. Thank you so much, Nils. You've been amazing. Thank you for joining me on Artist Insights.
Thank you, Phoebe. There was a great joy talking to you. And yeah, take care and hope to see you some other time.
If you enjoyed today's episode and want to learn more about Yamaha and our artists, please do tell your friends about the show and subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. We'll see you next time for another episode of Artist Insights with Yamaha.